The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is always a pleasure to be able to reconnect with one of the country's most highly regarded sports writers, John Feinstein. Of course, a very familiar name and voice to NPR listeners and to Morning Show listeners. I've had the pleasure of speaking with John Feinstein, I think, on five different occasions over the years. And today we're going to be talking about what I believe is his most recent book, and it's one of a number of books he has written so successfully with young readers in mind. This book is called Game Changers, and it is a follow-up on an earlier book called Benchwarmers, and it follows the athletic exploits of two sixth graders. And it is beautifully written. That earlier book, Benchwarmers, was about the sport of soccer. In this particular novel, for young readers, we are transported to the basketball court. And these two young people who find their desire to succeed at the game of basketball thwarted by a couple of different complications. And it's all written so effectively by John Feinstein. And we're going to talk with him for the next few minutes about this new book published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. John Feinstein, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Greg, it's good to talk to you again, and thank you for that very generous introduction. I appreciate it.
I am very impressed with how well you write in this genre for young readers. And, of course, that's not all that you do. In fact, you're probably best known for books that are not written necessarily with young readers in mind at all. Can you remind us about at what point you began devoting at least some of your time and energy into this kind of writing, and what drew you to this sort of arena?
Yeah, I can tell you exactly how it happened. In 2005, I was reading the book Hoot, that Carl Hiaasen wrote, a kid's book, with my son Danny, who was 10 at the time. And we loved the book. And as luck would have it, Carl Hiaasen and I have the same agent, Esther Newberg, in New York. And I wanted to drop Carl a note telling him how much we'd enjoyed it. So I called the office, and Esther's then assistant, Christine Balk, answered the phone. And as she was getting his email for me, she said, "Have you ever thought about writing children's books? You talk about your kids all the time." My kids were 10 and 7 at the time. And there's not that much in the sports genre for kids. And I thought, geez, you know, maybe that might be fun. I came up with an idea to set a book at the Final Four, since at that point I think I'd covered 28 of them. So it was a place, a place I knew. And I set a mystery there with two teenagers, a boy and a girl, who win a writing contest, one that actually exists, because I like my fiction to read as if it might be nonfiction, at least up to a certain point. That's why I put real people into all these books. And the book did great. It won the Edgar Allan Poe Award for mystery writing in the young adult category. It was a New York Times bestseller. And I enjoyed doing it because my kids were really my editors. They read behind me as I was writing the book, so I didn't sound like a dork when I had the kids, you know, when I was creating dialogue for the kids. Perfect example was my son pointed out to me that when kids instant messaged each other, they didn't write, "Are you there?" A-R-E-Y-O-U, they wrote the letter R, the letter U, and I learned from them. So it was a fun experience. The book did well, and this Game Changers is now my 14th book in the kids' mystery genre. And I got to tell you, not only has it been great fun, Greg, but it's been extremely gratifying because of the letters I've gotten and, you know, emails and things from parents. Parents of boys saying, "I have a son who doesn't like to read, but he loves sports, and I gave him your book, and when's the next one coming out?" And even better from the parents of girls, because in that first series that started with Last Shot, the Sports Beat series, there were six books, the girl, Susan Carroll, was the jock. She in book six, she makes the Olympic team as a swimmer. The boy is not. I mean, he loves sports, but he's not a jock. And in this book, in these books, Andy and Jeff are both good athletes. And a lot of parents have written to me and said, "Thank you for making the girl the jock. And thank you for acknowledging that in this day and age, girls are athletes the same way boys are athletes," which when I was growing up, Greg, was not the case because girls didn't have the opportunities. And then Title IX changed the world for the better. I have two daughters now, and they both play all sorts of sports.
Hmm. I remember us having an interview about your book Final Four, and I am so glad to see that was the start of something really big and really successful and really fun for you. For those of you just joining us,
certainly the start of something I've enjoyed greatly. that's for certain.
For sure. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with best-selling author John Feinstein about his latest book, yet another book for young readers called Game Changers. It follows up on an earlier novel, which was called Benchwarmers. Explain a little more about the two main characters who we would first meet in Benchwarmers and who we get to know even better in Game Changers.
Yeah, sure. Andrea, who goes by Andy, and Jeff are the two main characters. They're sixth graders, as I think you mentioned earlier. In Benchwarmers, the middle school where they both go does not have a girls' soccer team. It has a girls' field hockey team. Andy is a very good soccer player, and she wants to try out for the boys' team because she thinks she's good enough to make it. And, in fact, she is. But there's a misogynist coach who doesn't think girls should be on a boys' team, and so he cuts her, even though she's probably one of the three or four best players out there. And Jeff, whose dad works for a local TV station in Philadelphia, helps her get on the team by publicizing what the coach has been doing. And that's really where the plot evolves from, and the two of them become good friends, and Andy becomes a very important player on the team and has to win over not only the coach but some of her teammates. Not all of them, but some of them. And you wish in 2020 that sort of thing didn't exist, just as we wish in 2020 that racism didn't exist, but they do. And in this book, the second one, Game Changers, now it's basketball season. Jeff's on the boys' team, and Andy's on the girls' team. And the boys' team has, you know, squabbles that 11- and 12-year-olds will have, trying to figure out how to get along with one another and how to play as a team. I always try to – I don't want to preach in these books, Greg, but I try to put messages in there for the kids about what's right and what's wrong and about how you deal with things in sports and in life. The girls' team has a bigger problem. They have a coach who's a racist, who stereotypes the African-American kids on the team, and mostly out of ignorance. And the girls, as the season goes on, realize what's going on. And eventually they revolt, and that's where the plot kind of builds to a crescendo. And again, it gets back. I wrote this book long before George Floyd was murdered because I've always thought that that race has been the elephant in the room in sports and in our society for years. I mean, just go back to Colin Kaepernick and go back to the national anthem protests of 2017 and the way so many white people reacted to them. And of course, we've seen it more now, sadly, in the last 6 months. But it gets back again to my belief that kids who are reading these books, middle schoolers, high schoolers, whomever they might be, they know what's going on in the world. And they can read this and go, yeah, that can happen in real life.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's very interesting about this book is that we so like the two main protagonists, Jeff and Andy. I mean, they're not only talented athletes, but they're just good kids. I mean, really,
right.
Just good, all-around, likable kids. And yet, they get in trouble. And I don't mean get in trouble in the sense of, you know, smoking behind the shed kind of trouble. But
right.
But they get in trouble because of what they're doing with the very, very best of intentions. And I think that is really an interesting idea, to have two good kids who nevertheless do not find the way easy, sometimes exactly because that they are good kids with principles and integrity, and sometimes the adults in their lives don't know what to make of that. Can you tell us more about just how ripe that kind of ground is for writing a novel?
First of all, I'm a big believer that there are often times when we can learn from our kids. I know I have throughout my life, or ever since I've had kids. But beyond that, as a reader, when I'm writing, I try to think, I think like the reader that I am, not just the writer. And if somebody has, if I see a movie or read a book and there's nobody to root for, I have trouble getting into it. I think you need somebody to root for. It can't just be all bad guys. And throughout all of these kids' books I've written now, 14 of them, I've tried to have protagonists that the reader wants to root for. But you're right, they do get in trouble. I would never compare myself to J.K. Rowling because she's a genius. But in the Harry Potter books, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, who are all good kids, are constantly in trouble because they step out of the lines of behavior that are supposed to exist in order to try to find out who the bad guys are and how to stop the bad guys. Now, on a completely different level, that's what Jeff and Andy are doing in this book. Andy is the one who first stands up and says, this is wrong in terms of the way their coach is handling them. And Jeff is the one who tries to get the team to come together in spite of the fact that there are a couple of very good players that nobody really likes. And he tries to do the right things, and Andy tries to do the right things. And I think because of that, even though, as you said correctly, they do get in trouble, they're getting in trouble for trying to do the right things, for trying to make things better for the people around them.
Right, exactly. Another thing that's interesting in your book, and I'm really glad that this element is there as well, is that there are other good kids in Game Changers, and then there are some kids that seem to, at least at first, sort of play the role of semi-villains. I mean,
right.
not terrible kids, but not nearly so likable as Jeff and Andy. And without giving too much away, in a couple of instances, either they change or we change in terms of how we perceive these kids that at first really seem like, you know, they're wearing the black hats and Andy and Jeff are wearing the white hats, so to speak. And I just wonder if you could just say a word about how tricky it is to make that plausible for somebody to in fact not be the villain that we at first think that they are. It's a great device.
Well, I think you hit on it in the way you asked the question. And you said they maybe wear the black hats, but they're not terrible people. And so it's easier to have characters who have maybe done some things wrong, said some things that are wrong, learn as we go along in the book than if they're just pure evil. You know, I'm a big believer that there's no real black and white in terms of most people, putting the current president aside, in the world, that everybody has flaws, and even, you know, bad people who appear to be bad have good streaks in them. There's no better example in my life than Bob Knight, who the good side of Bob Knight was as good as anybody I've ever met. The bad side of Bob Knight was almost as bad as anybody I've ever met. And both were very much a part of his character. And so I've always believed that if you can take kids, you know, there are some mean girls in this book early on. But as time goes by and they come to understand what's going on around them, and when Andy and some of the other kids help them understand what's going on around them, they do change. And they don't necessarily, I mean, change in the sense of changing the way that they're looking at things. I don't think people completely change their personalities, but and so I don't think it's that hard to make the evolution of these kids plausible when you start out with the premise that they're not just, they're not evil. They're just people who are, they're 11 and 12 year olds. They're learning, and they grow up through this process.
Another thing I really appreciate about this book, right off the bat, it reminded me of something that I really hate about the old TV show Glee, and a lot of shows like that, in which the students are a whole lot smarter than the teachers, that the teachers are all kind of bumbling idiots,
right.
To a cartoonish extent. I just, as someone who's a teacher, I guess that's one reason why that really rubs me wrong. And so
I'm the husband of a teacher, so I understand.
Right. And that being said, I really appreciate the fact that when the teachers and coaches in your book, in a sense, get in the way of the protagonists, it's not because they're dumb. It's not because they're clueless. It's not because they're heartless. It's often because they are adults and they are viewing things through a very different lens than the youngsters are. And so when it comes to something like the sixth grade basketball team, I mean, certain decisions are made about who's going to coach the girls' team, and they're choices that that those sixth graders certainly wouldn't make, and it makes no sense to them and so on, but it does make some sense to the adults. And I really appreciate that you've set up that dynamic as carefully as you do. And I wonder if you can just say a word about the care with which you have tried to shape the adults that are in this novel.
Well, again, I don't think adults are black and white any more than kids are black and white. And there are teachers who are better teachers than others. There are coaches that are better coaches than others in the real world. And how many times do we say to our kids when we're trying to explain something and they don't seem to, they either don't want to get it or don't get it, and you say, you'll understand when you're older. Well, sometimes they will, and sometimes we understand that they were making a very good point. I think that's the best way you parent, is to understand that maybe you're wrong sometimes. You make wrong decisions and try to correct them as best you can. And the same is true of teaching or coaching or being in any position of authority, regardless of the what kind of life you're leading. And so in this book, there are coaches and teachers who are trying to do things for the right reasons, and maybe they're still getting it wrong. You know, it's like the old saying in coaching: sometimes you make the right decision and it turns out wrong. You send a pitcher to the mound who you think's going to get that last out, and he ends up giving up a home run. You know, it happens. But I think that again, I try very hard in all of these books to have the characters evolve, to have them learn. I want the kids to learn. As I said, I try to send messages in the way I write these books without preaching. And by having all the characters learn as they go in Game Changers and in these other books, I think it makes it more real, and I think it makes it more fun to read. In the first book, in Benchwarmers, the coach who wants to cut Andy from the soccer team at the start of the season because he doesn't think a girl should be playing with boys, comes 180 degrees and realizes that her being on the team has been a very good thing, and becomes a defender of hers because he's not a bad person. He was just a person who was living in the past, as many people do. It's still hard. I'll give you an example in football. And in the NFL draft 3 years ago, the Chicago Bears somehow took Mitchell Trubisky ahead of Patrick Mahomes and Deshaun Watson, who were both available, with the number two pick. And I believe, and many people I know and respect in the NFL believe, that there was a racial element to it. That, you know, Mitchell Trubisky looked like what most fans would want in an NFL quarterback. The problem was he wasn't nearly as good as Patrick Mahomes or Deshaun Watson. And so the Bears now are in a position where they're terrible and they need a quarterback. And look at the Kansas City Chiefs.
There you go.
Right. And it doesn't mean that Ryan Pace, the general manager, was a bad person. It just means he was a guy living in the past to some degree.
And probably
he's probably going to lose his job at the end of the season.
Right, and probably not aware of it in the same way that this coach in your novel, who is to us quite obviously racist,
right.
In her own mind.
And she's shocked.
Yeah, in her own mind does not see that at all. And that's also kind of a fascinating journey. I also appreciate that your novel is, let's say, lightly peppered with references to things that are outside of the exploits of these two basketball teams, but not a lot. And, I mean, I think sometimes, you know, there might be part of us that would wish that, well, I mean, are they ever in math class, or does anything ever else happen, you know, outside of, and these two characters, in a sense, seem really quite kind of consumed with what's going on. And, of course, that, at least generally speaking, is often the way sixth graders operate. I mean, and when someone is, for instance, a talented basketball player, that really is of paramount importance, and that's where their energies are focused. And in that same way, that sort of, it feels very plausible or very authentic that that's kind of the way Jeff and Andy see the world and kind of the way you've shaped this world in your novel.
Well, I think some of that at least comes from my own experience, to be honest, because I was a jock as a kid. I played all sports. I grew up in an era where you played all sports as opposed to nowadays where parents try to have their kids focus on one sport by the time they're 10 years old and be obsessed with it 12 months a year, which I think is completely wrong, but that's another subject for another day. I remember when I was in the eighth grade, I was a little bit older, I had an English grammar teacher I couldn't stand. And I wasn't particularly interested in English grammar, and that's why I still make grammatical mistakes in my writing to this day. But my English grammar class was last period. And I figured out that if I said something, because he didn't like me either, if I said something early in class that he didn't like, he was going to throw me out. And that meant I could go downstairs and get ready for basketball practice 45 minutes earlier than anybody else. Go down and shoot and get ready. And so I literally got myself thrown out of English class just about every day until the teacher finally figured out what I was doing and stopped throwing me out. And so that's to your point that, sure, if you're a jock, Jeff and Andy are both jocks, the most important thing in your life are the sports you're playing. Now, that doesn't mean you don't go to school, and I've certainly got in trouble with my parents because of my relationship with this teacher. But that's what kids do. I think you're completely right. That's what kids do. And Andy is a very good student. Jeff is an okay student. Girls usually are better students than boys, at least in my experience with my three kids. So I hear what you're saying, and there's no question that it's true. And when I became a swimmer in high school, that was all I cared about, was swimming, because ultimately I realized swimming was what was going to get me into college, not my grades.
Hmm. Well, and of course, if Andy and Jeff weren't so, in a sense, consumed, in the best sense of the word, by what was going on with their basketball teams and what was going wrong, then, in a sense, they wouldn't go on kind of the dramatic and sort of almost dangerous journey that they undertake to try to make what they see as really bad situations better. And if somebody had kind of a lackadaisical attitude about this basketball team, well, it really doesn't matter. Well, then all these things going wrong don't matter either. But in fact, it all matters terribly to Jeff and to Andy. And they're really willing to do just about anything to try to make it.
Well, they don't care, Greg. If they don't care the way you're describing, then there's no book.
Right. And there very much is a book. I mean, and we are so taken up with these two young people and in a sense their respective causes, and it just reads so excitingly. I loved it. I mean, as a 60-year-old and not even much of a basketball fan, I absolutely loved this book. I really, really did, and I know especially young people will enjoy Game Changers, published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux, and the author John Feinstein. John Feinstein, congratulations on yet another wonderful book, and thank you for being part of the Morning
Show. Thanks for having me. I hope we do it again, and happy holidays.
You too. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's morning show comes from the Morning Show Archives, an interview originally recorded and broadcast back in 2017. My guest for this portion of WGTD's morning show is Dr. David Geyer, who is a highly regarded orthopedic surgeon and sports medicine specialist, who not only helps young athletes to recover from their injuries, but also helps the rest of us understand the nature of such injuries, the ways in which such serious injuries perhaps can be avoided, or the risk at least can be lessened, and helps us understand the reality of what an athlete, especially an elite athlete, is facing in trying to come back from what are often devastating injuries, and injuries that once upon a time would have meant the end of their career. But now, with the wonders of modern medicine, it is possible for many athletes to return to the field, to the court, and in some cases, even return to achieve every bit the excellence that they had achieved even before their injury. Dr. Geyer's new book is called That's Gotta Hurt, The Injuries That Changed Sports Forever, in which he examines a number of specific athletes and specific injuries which they suffered, which really helped sort of change the game in the sense of helping us understand the nature of certain injuries and what it means to come back from such from such devastating injuries. And it's a very, very interesting book published by 4EDGE. Dr. David Geyer, we welcome you to the morning show.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. I'm curious if you came into the field of sports medicine as an athlete yourself, and if that's one reason why all of this is so interesting to you, or were you simply drawn to medicine and then for no particular reason drawn to the arena of sports medicine specifically?
Well, I was an athlete. I wouldn't call myself a terrific athlete. I didn't play, obviously, in the pros or even at the college level. I did play travel soccer and a variety of other sports, and still like to be active now, lift weights every day and do a variety of other things. So in a lot of ways, I still consider myself an athlete. I just don't get paid to do it.
Hmm. You begin your really interesting book with an event that occurred back in 1970. And as we first begin reading it, we have no idea the particular person you are talking about or the particular incident. And the longer we read it, the more it starts to become clear which moment in sports you are talking about. And it's not an elite athlete in the sense of anybody that any of us have heard of, and yet it's somebody that just about all of us have seen. Explain to our listeners how your book begins and why you chose to begin it this way.
Yeah, I think that's great. It's a name, you're right, nobody knows, a guy named Vinko Bogataj, and I may be mispronouncing that. He was a Slovenian ski, I think they, now it's basically, they call it ski flying back then, but it's what we think of with the downhill skiing, the ramps, the ski jumping, and he was the legendary crash on the wide world of sports, and, you know, the agony of defeat guy. His crash follows those words, and I chose him because wide world of sports sort of paralleled the explosion in sports in terms of the prominence in society with 24/7 cable sports coverage and talk radio and the internet. But it also was a moment that had a tremendous impact on the sport. You don't think much of that one
ski jumper basically having a crash, and you think it's interesting and you hate it for him, but we never really heard what happened to him. He really did not suffer that significant of an injury. He had a concussion, but he was fine. But it had a devastating impact on the sport of ski jumping. Basically, that footage being shown week after week convinced parents that the sport was really unsafe, and basically it really went away largely in the United States. There were other factors, but that's what I wanted to show in this book, how one injury could have a tremendous impact, both positive and negative, on the sports and on the athletes.
Right. In this case, perhaps dissuading certain people from pursuing a sport that looked very, very dangerous. If all you know about this sport is this infamous bit of film footage, and of course in other cases, your book explores ways in which a particularly devastating injury helped maybe change the way the rules were written for a sport, or the way in which equipment was designed to safeguard the well-being of the athletes. And in some cases, we are talking about sports injuries that perhaps helped to prompt or helped bring into focus new ways of treating such a devastating injury. That's part of the way in which we learn about one of the greatest female runners of all time, the great Joan Benoit, who won the first gold medal for women's marathon running at the Olympics. That was back in 1984. But not long before that, Joan Benoit had suffered a very, very serious knee injury. Explain what made her injury so serious and what made the treatment of it, in a sense, so groundbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a fascinating story. She was training, as you say, for the first ever women's marathon in the Olympics, training for the Olympic trials. She was the world record holder at the time and was easily going to win that, and started developing this pain in her knee that was not getting better. She was seeing doctors all over the country, getting all these treatments, getting shots in her knee, and nothing was working. And so she saw a doctor that was affiliated with Nike, who sponsored Benoit, and he said, hey, we've got one last thing to try. Let's scope your knee. Let's do an arthroscopic knee surgery, which was fairly novel at the time. It seems so commonplace now, but basically he was able to look in through small incisions with a camera, find the source of the pain and take care of it. And she was able to compete 17 days later after that surgery and win the marathon trials, which even today would be unheard of, to be able to compete at that level 17 days after arthroscopic knee surgery. But that raised so much attention. It really put arthroscopic surgery on the map. And now it's one of the most common surgeries in all of medicine.
Hmm. You also go on from there to tell the story of a legendary basketball player by the name of Bernard King and his return after a devastating ACL injury. And essentially what you say in this chapter is that not long before that, this kind of injury would have really spelled the end of such an athlete's career, or at the very best, they might have limped back and hobbled around playing maybe at a third of the level that they played before. And so Bernard King's comeback was quite extraordinary. Explain how such a comeback was possible.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And before Bernard King's time, doctors, we would put patients in casts and let their knee become stable, but it would get really stiff. And you just can't play sports at a high level with a stiff knee. And so it ended their careers. Bernard King was determined to not have that happen. So he underwent a surgery that has become very common, but then a grueling rehab over a couple of years, getting his motion back, getting his strength back. And he got back to play at an all-star level. He made the all-star game. He was the first elite athlete to be able to do that. And it really set the way now for basically all athletes expect to be able to get back to play at the same level. And it's not just pro athletes, even though we have good success rates at that level, but it's high school kids, college kids, even younger than that, and then adults that just like to play sports and exercise. Now 100 to 150,000 Americans get that surgery every year, and because of the changes, the advances we've made, we can expect that they're going to get back to do what they love to do.
We're speaking with Dr. David Guyer about his book, That's Gotta Hurt, The Injuries That Change Sports Forever. By the way, I wanted you to share with our listeners one really beautiful moment from this chapter about Bernard King. And it really underscores how grateful he was to the doctor that had helped make his comeback possible. Tell our listeners about Bernard King's ability to return and make the All-Star team and the gesture which he made upon that occasion.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really great. So Bernard King, everybody told him that there's no chance he's ever going to get back to play, but for good reason. Nobody really did before him. But, you know, he had a terrific surgeon, Dr. Norman Scott, who is the doctor of his team, the New York Knicks, and his physical therapist, Daniel Schweitzer, who he would basically see 5 days a week at his house. She would drive from Manhattan into New Jersey to work with him every single day for well over a year. And the three of them, they worked so hard. And to be fair, he makes the comment, really, they were the only three that thought it was possible that he could play again in the NBA. So when he made the All-Star team, he brought Dr. Scott, he brought Daniel Schweitzer and her husband to the All-Star game, gave him signed basketballs, because he was so grateful that basically it was just the three of them that believed he could do it. And sure enough, he did.
Hmm. Yeah, I like the way he says something to the effect that there were three people. It was the culmination of a dream that only three people thought possible. And of course, one of those three was Dr. Norman Scott, who was there to cheer him on. Your book goes on to explore the stories of a number of different athletes and various injuries, and for the most part, we're talking about, you know, sort of the stories of what we've just recounted with these first two. But in some cases, we're talking about injuries that sort of give us access to more overarching questions. And I wanted to take a little bit of time to talk about this. In Chapter 8, where you are really exploring the notion of medical evaluation and clearance of athletes to play, and in the chapter, I think, that comes right after that about Michael Jordan, where we're talking about the question of how an athlete can and should decide whether or not to return to play. I mean, at what point is it better for me to get out there and play again? Let's talk first about the whole matter of medical evaluation and clearance. I think your chapter here really underscores how tricky a matter this is, and really crucially important too. Tell us the story of this particular athlete and how it sort of raises this really intriguing issue.
Yeah, so I start the chapter talking about Sam Bowie, who probably not a real household name unless you're a diehard NBA fan, but he was the player drafted right before Michael Jordan in the 1984 NBA draft, and it's widely regarded to be the worst draft pick of all time. One, because Jordan became the best player ever to play, but Sam Bowie also couldn't stay healthy. He had multiple injuries, and during college, he missed 2 years of college because of a stress fracture in his leg. And it explores the whole question of, is that something that the team and the doctors should have been able to predict? Could he have a problem that was not going to keep him from staying healthy? And Portland, the team that drafted Sam Bowie, has a history of drafting multiple players that just haven't been able to stay healthy, Bill Walton and Greg Oden and Brandon Roy. And so it explores the whole question of, you know, how do we tell? You know, if they've had an injury, how do we know they've fully recovered? Yes, we can get x-rays, and now we get MRIs, and we can. There's lots of things we can do, but we can't see pain, and we can't necessarily predict the future. There's a lot of analytics going on right now, a lot of studying of statistics, to get to where we can predict these injuries and how well that's going to predict how, if a, you know, basically an athlete can play, can stay on the court, stay on the field. But at the end of the day, with millions and millions of dollars on the line, you know, these, if you're wrong, I mean, it's devastating for a franchise. And it's really, like you say, very tricky to figure out, despite our best tests and surgeries.
Mm. Yeah, and you really don't envy the doctor who is placed in that position. I mean, you certainly don't envy the athlete either, but you really don't envy the doctor who shoulders the responsibility of clearing an athlete to play. And yes, I like in your this chapter about Sambui, this sort of irony that there was actually Michael Jordan who suffered an injury quicker than Mr. Bowie did, and there were at least a few people who were saying, wow, it's a good thing we drafted Sambui instead of Michael Jordan. And then, of course, Michael Jordan eventually goes on to this long and extraordinary career, and Sambui just can't quite stay healthy. Really underscores for all that an athlete can do to remain healthy and be in the best shape that can possibly be, it's about more than that, and it's a capricious thing, and sometimes good luck and bad luck has at least some role to play in this.
Yeah, it really does, unfortunately. And that gets to sort of the bigger picture, too, and I write about this later on in the book about how does this apply to all of us, that we just love to play sports and exercise. And I think it stresses points like getting your injuries checked out by a doctor early and not trying to push through it to make sure it's not something serious. It talks about taking enough time to rehab to make sure you're 100%, and then it introduces the concepts of at what point do we, after so many injuries or so many aches and pains, do we say, hey, maybe I shouldn't do this anymore? You know, these guys, you know, I talk about Bill Walton in the Sambui chapter, had 37 surgeries. You know, at what point do we say, hey, you know, we got to stop and stop putting the wear and tear on our bodies? But yeah, you're right. If the guys that can stay healthy, the adults listening to this, that, you know, if they can stay healthy, you know, that's great for being able to play with your kids and being able to run in your 60s and 70s. And we're getting better in the sports medicine world at helping people do that. But you're right. A lot of it is dependent on luck and your body makeup.
Right. And of course, as we said, you explore this question of when should an athlete return to play in a chapter devoted to the great Michael Jordan, one of the great legends. The Bulls won 6 NBA championships. He was league MVP 5 times, NBA Finals MVP 6 times, a 14-time All-Star. And yet he found himself, although he certainly did not have an injury-ridden career, he couldn't have done what he did. On the other hand, Michael Jordan faced all kinds of injuries during that long career, and over again had to sort of figure out the best way for him to listen to his own body.
And that was really a source of concern of his during, especially early in his career when he had the fracture in his foot that caused him to miss about half a season. He did listen to his body and said, look, I feel fine, I can play. But the doctors and the team held him out for many, many weeks after that. And it's interesting because that's sort of the opposite of what we hear now. These players at the pro level feel that doctors are trying to rush them back before they're healed because the team needs them to play and the fans, you know, they make money on the fans and ticket sales. And so there's these stories about how pro athletes don't trust their doctors. So it's an interesting sort of dilemma in terms of, you know, communication between the doctor and the athlete and the team and trying to figure out what's best, yes, you know, for short term, getting somebody back to play, but doing it in a way that doesn't risk shortening an athlete's career and hurting their long-term health. And it's really a tricky problem, more than you would really think. And so I go into that in a lot of detail because we, at the end of the day, have to keep these guys healthy, not just so they can play longer and make money longer, but so they can play with their kids and be active later in life.
Hmm. It's also important for us to acknowledge that sometimes injury and other issues can not only lead to devastation later in life, such as what we've heard so much about with head injuries, perpetual head injuries that can really cause long-term brain damage, which you explore in a chapter about Dave Duerson. But also there are those rare instances in which we are even sometimes talking about an athlete's life tragically coming to an abrupt end. You talk about that in a chapter about a member of the Minnesota Vikings named Corey Stringer. And some of our listeners, at least, I'm sure, remember this tragic story of Corey Stringer dying after collapsing due to heat stroke. Say a word about this and how we can safeguard against such tragedies from recurring.
Yeah, it was devastating. It was basically, and you don't think of Minnesota being somewhere that's really hot, but it was in the, you know, 100, close to 100 degrees, really hot humidity in training camp, and the players are in, you know, pads and helmets, and he basically started overheating, had, you know, heat, went into heat stroke where he became confused, and by the time the ambulance got there and they got him to the hospital, his temperature was over 108 degrees, and they couldn't save him. What's important about it is that that's largely a preventable problem, both from hydration and getting gradually used to hot and humid conditions with adding longer practices and two-a-days and adding in equipment slowly, and that's really been implemented, especially at the high school and college level, but also recognizing heat stroke and starting immediate treatment on site, not waiting for the ambulance to take them to the hospital, but do the ice water baths and things on site. And we've gotten to where we can pretty much eliminate any player dying if the right steps are taken, but it still happens 5 to 10 times a year. So while it is preventable, which is a really good thing, we still have to get the awareness out there, the education out there to keep these athletes alive.
Hmm. At the end of your book, I think one of the things you touch on in your conclusion is that these breakthroughs in medical science can help us keep our athletes safe and can make comebacks possible that a few years ago would have been absolutely inconceivable. Sort of the double edge of it is it makes fans of sports and athletes themselves also perhaps tempted to be impatient or to have outsized expectations about what is possible. We still have to be careful. We still have to listen to our own bodies.
You're absolutely right. I mean, these concepts still apply to all of us. You know, listen to our bodies, not trying to push through pain, get it checked out. But it's also leading to, are we going to follow the path of the pros who are willing to try treatments like stem cells and PRP that are sort of unproven right now and not paid for by insurance? What's the role of that for us, that we just like to lift weights or run? I think that it's an exciting times in terms of what we're going to be able to do to heal active people. But there's still a lot of questions we have to answer if we're going to keep people healthy into their 60s and 70s.
This is a very, very interesting book. 13 different athletes are profiled and their stories, including the Tommy John surgery that is so well known in baseball, and as we mentioned earlier, the long term effects of brain damage for football players and for other athletes, for that matter, the dangers of extreme sports and so on. So much is explored in such thoughtful fashion in this book called "That's Gotta Hurt: The Injuries That Changed Sports Forever," published by 4Edge, and the author, Dr. David Geyer. Dr. Geyer, thank you so much for making time in your busy schedule for this conversation. I enjoyed this. Best wishes.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a program I'm very, very excited about. I'm going to be sharing with you interviews that I'm going to be, that I've recorded with three area high school choral directors. Elizabeth Stege from Case High School in Racine, Polly Amborn, the choral director at Tremper High School in Kenosha, and Derek Mahan, choir director at Waterford Union High School. We're going to be finding out about how these three choral directors have been contending with the COVID-19 pandemic and what it has been like for them. As it turns out, in each of these three high schools, It's been a very different situation. Case High School has been, for the most part, entirely virtual. Tremper High School has kind of toggled back and forth in a mixed situation, and Waterford High School has had its own version of hybrid delivery of education. It's been a complicated, but in many ways also invigorating and inspiring experience for all three of these choral directors, and you will hear from them tomorrow on The Morning Show. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year.